Right now it is time for David Tarasek with the Media Beat. David joins us on a Friday morning. We broadcast it over the weekend and after our 12 noon news during the week as well. David is a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. He has a terrific website, themediabeat.us, and we are always pleased to have him join us on a Friday morning, even when it is a grim Friday morning after the week that has unfolded. Good morning, David.
Well, good to be with you, even in this grim week, Marshall. I'm still in Maine, the great state of Maine, instead of the media capital of the world, New York City, where I'm normally based. But, of course, the media world, like all of us, has been rocked by the news from Afghanistan.
You know, it's one of those things that was predicted. And as a matter of fact, our intelligence was so good that morning they advised people to stay away from certain gates at the airport. But what it goes to show you, and it's an old saying, is that with modern-day terrorists, ever since really 9/11, when modern-day terrorists had just threw everything out the window and no longer really wanted to hijack a plane or never really wanted to hijack a person, they're just out now to kill and maim. And if that's going to happen, especially in a situation like you have right now in Afghanistan, there's very little you can do about it, really.
Yeah, well, the term of art, if I can use that unpleasant phrase, is asymmetric warfare. And it's certainly the case that small groups without a lot of resources have enormous capacity to inflict damage, if as they do, of course, and that's been made very clear over the last 20 years, and before that, too. Terrorism, if I can use that very loose term, has got a different flavor when you are prepared as an asymmetric force, a very small, under-resourced collection of activists, as I say, are prepared to not only kill other people, but kill themselves in the process. The suicide bomber phenomenon is one that, of course, it's that very, very much more that difficult, that much more difficult, so much more difficult to get a hold of, because, of course, that's not what it's not what we're primed for as warriors, no matter how effective we might be, expecting that the person who's arraigned their forces or the organization that's arraigned its forces against us is prepared to kill themselves in the process makes it that much more difficult to counter. In this case, as you say, the intelligence was there, and it was very specific, right down to the location and the nature of the offense, the nature of the attack, and the identity of the organization that was planning the attack. The chatter was very clear. It was about people, or in this case, just two individuals, in two slightly separated spaces, wearing a suicide vest. And of course, knowing is not the same as preventing. And that was so very clear. The chaotic situation outside Kabul airport is beyond any kind of control, it seems, especially since, as the military sources are pointing out to journalists all the time in this situation, they're conducting this operation while surrounded by an urban area that's under the control of an enemy force. And in this particular case, of course, the two people wearing suicide vests will have had to have gone through some form of perimeter control by the Taliban before they got to the point where they were prepared to explode themselves and kill what is now reckoned to be probably 100 people and injured many more. And the 100 deaths, of course, include 13 American troops, mostly Marines, it would appear. We've got an intractable situation, and who knows if it's over. The likelihood is that there could well be other attacks in the remaining 5 days, which America has allowed itself to complete this operation.
Yeah, one of the things I mentioned when we brought more people in to secure the airport and to secure people's exit is the amazingly outstanding job that those troops have done. They've managed to not infuriate the people who are lined up and desperate to try to get out. They've managed to not get in shootouts with the Taliban. And 13 gave their lives so people can get out and seek freedom, and they're going to be there, and they're going to do their job until the last plane leaves. And it is, you know, to see the briefing that took place yesterday by the military, and they were so open with this briefing day. I don't know if you saw it or not, but I was just amazed at how open the briefing was and how frank and honest the answers were.
Yeah, they were confronting the reality and being clear about not just the mission, but the problems of the mission and indeed the failure in this particular case. And of course, there's no way around that. I mean, many times over, you will see politicians doing their best to wriggle out of responsibility, but there's a very clear sense there of the military mind at work recognizing that, yes, this was a bad day for them. And a bad day for all of us because of what it means. And it's important, as you say, not to forget the fact that the mission continues. Not only is the mission continuing, but it has already demonstrated the capacity of what we were talking about last week, a military force, the U.S. military, which without a doubt is probably one of the most powerful and effective logistical organizations in the world, and organizing this airlift is a considerable achievement already. 100,000 people shipped out over this last week, but we must always, of course, put that in the context of the overall need, and we are left, even if after August the 31st, next Tuesday, we're talking about as the planned end of this operation. We are still left with a gigantic problem. Some very effective journalism this week from the New York Times, which has been estimating by using Department of Defense, his own employment figures and other sources like support groups for the Afghan individuals who've been affiliated with the U.S. and U.S. forces and U.S. organizations over the last 20 years. Using those sources, the New York Times is calculating that there will still be after August 31st something like 250,000 eligible people who would qualify for the special immigrant visas and the other kind of visas, the so-called priority 2 visas, which would entitle them to come to the United States. So the problem is far from over, even if we ship out more people before next Tuesday.
It's a situation that right now just unfortunately bears watching and having family members of service members pray and hope everything goes okay. It's living in modern times, and what's even...
And knowing the enemy, too,
yeah,
of course.
Yeah.
It's important, Marshall, to understand the nature of your opponent, and that's part of the problem in this case. I think many assumptions were made and turned out to be wrong. One of the extraordinary pieces of opinion journalism that I saw over the last week was from the pretty always redoubtable writer in the shape of Maureen Dowd, and again the New York Times. But of course, journalism in this area has been vigorous in all outlets. Let me quote Maureen Dowd, though. We didn't know 9/11 was coming, she says, even though we should have. We didn't know January the 6th was coming, even though we should have. We didn't know the government in Afghanistan that we'd propped up for 2 decades would fall in 2 seconds, even though we should have. What else don't we know? Well, we know about ISIS-K, and we know more than perhaps the public has generally been made aware of, but supposedly beaten 2 years ago in its claimed heartland around Mosul in Iraq in particular. ISIS, remember, does stand in the English initials, at least, for Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, supposedly beaten in March 2019, as I say, is, of course, its very widely spread affiliates in Africa, both North Africa and West Africa, and even in an old stamping ground of mine in Southern Africa. It has reached that far with an affiliate in Mozambique, even, reportedly, at least, on the Indian Ocean coastline of Southern Africa. And unsurprisingly, of course, they are in Afghanistan, too, for the last 6 years or so under the name of ISIS-K, a name that even the president was raising last Tuesday. And it's important to recognize what kind of organization we're dealing with here, mostly defectors from the Taliban, from the Pakistan Taliban and the Afghan Taliban. Their feeling is that the Taliban itself is just insufficiently pure in its jihadism. So that's what we're dealing with. Hundreds, getting on for 1,000 perhaps, attacks in the last 6+ years that they've been active, sometimes in other parts of that region, attacking CIA targets, for instance, in Bangladesh. So we're dealing with, as I was saying before, an asymmetric force, but one that is capable of inflicting damage way out of proportion to its own size. And it's clear how opposed they are to the Taliban, too. The Taliban, as it took over last week, showed how much of an enemy they regard ISIS-K to be to them, in that they took its leader, its former leader at least, Abu Omar Khorasani, an interesting name. Khorasani reflects the Khorasan, which is the K in ISIS-K, the region, the old Persian Empire area, Khorasan. But Abu Omar Khorasani was taken out of his jail, Afghan prison where he'd been kept, and one of the first killings they did as they took over the country last week was to kill him. So we've got an internal division here in Afghanistan itself, but with one enemy who regards the Taliban as much of an enemy as it regards the United States as an enemy. So that's the nature of the threat we're facing.
And I think that as more news coverage covers this, this is a clear message as to why America's role in Afghanistan had to end, whether it was sooner or later, simply because you're not fighting a war to gain. There's so many disparate parts and so many enemies that hate one another and hate you that it is virtually a situation that is deadlocked for, it has been deadlocked in that country for hundreds of years and will continue to be. There's no answer out unless it's grown from within that country itself, by people within the country itself. It's just one of those questions now that should be clear in everybody's mind that getting out is the right thing to do.
And a very firm defensive posture and response, of course. I mean, what yeah. We know now, of course, is that blooded in this way and scoring what in grim terms has to be reckoned in the ledger, the ugly ledger of terrorist warfare as a success, they will be wanting to do more, no doubt. And the defensive capability of America's much lauded military force is going to be tested to the extreme.
And the interesting quote that came out of Joe Biden, once again President Biden, to hunt down the attackers, it'll be very interesting to see if they can actually isolate and use some of that incredible intelligence power that we have to actually find these people. And But I don't know, you know, the terms bring to justice. There is no justice here, David. It's just, unfortunately, terrorism. And justice does not prevail in terrorism.
Well, Biden's address to the country from the East Room yesterday and taking questions afterwards was not the most powerful of his career. He did appear very shaken, but on the other hand, there was a very solid piece of oratory in at the core of it. When he could say with the simplicity that he's sometimes very, very capable of and is forceful because of, he said, "We won't forgive, we won't forget, we will hunt you down and make you pay." And that, I think, is the core of America's position now. But as I say, it ranges more widely now because there has to be a huge responsibility on our intelligence gathering services. The defensive posture has to be very thoroughgoing. I think, you know, it wouldn't be a bad idea just to consider this as a time when we all have to be ultra-cautious about how we live our lives, wherever in the world we are, because we know that the long arm of even small organizations is very hard to calculate.
And it's a lesson that you covered for many years in Northern Ireland, and of course we've seen throughout growth throughout the world. There's really not much you can do about it except to be on guard.
Yes, and being on guard is a international responsibility. The fact that we have allies, we're going to have to rely upon them even more now that we're in the process of taking out from Afghanistan all the U.S. boots on the ground, and we're one of the international institutions that we can perhaps not rely on, but have some sense of its value to us, is the United Nations. You know, I have a slight bias here because I've worked with the U.N. for many years. But we mustn't forget the degree that they can help with intelligence, too. And one of the things that came up for me this week was a recent United Nations report that concluded that something like 8,000 to 10,000 militant jihadist fighters drawn from this great range of source countries in Central Asia, in the North Caucasus area of Russia, from Pakistan, unsurprisingly, I guess, but also from the Xinjiang region in western China on the other side of Afghanistan, have poured into Afghanistan in recent months while the Taliban was in its rush to take over. And most are associated with the Taliban or Al-Qaeda, but others, importantly, I think, we should register this, have become allied with ISIS-K. So the evidence is there. The putting together of intelligence and mounting the proper and effective defense against it is going to be a challenge for our intelligence services. But we know how to do it. I mean, that's one of the things that's become very clear. Although the commission investigating the 9/11 crisis and disaster that was for the intelligence services and for all our military services, has shown that we need the collaboration of intelligence sources around the world, and the picture is becoming clearer. An event like yesterday makes us want to focus as clearly as we possibly can, and the evidence is clear: is that ISIS-K is an organization to watch, but we mustn't forget that there are many other threats that are in the same league, and the asymmetric nature of the combat suggests that we would pay very close attention even to organizations that don't quite seem important enough at a given moment. You just never know when they might develop the capacity to strike us hard.
All right, now one final thing I want to get to and away from Afghanistan, which slid by yesterday, and even though the Biden administration knew this was going to happen, they announced the moratorium on evictions, and the Supreme Court yesterday put an end to that, basically saying that it was a rule that was passed by Congress, and if it's going to be continued, the law has to be redone by Congress. Once again, that was a 6-3 vote by the Supreme Court yesterday.
Yes, and no surprise there in the political, if you like, coloring of the majority on the Supreme Court bench. What it does mean, whatever the argument about the intricacies of the moratorium on evictions, and we've had a couple now of attempts at making sure that it would continue and not expire the way that it was threatening to do, and of course now has. It will now expire because of the Supreme Court's decision, and as a result there will be hundreds of thousands of tenants at risk of being put out of their houses, and that's a reality on the ground. As you say, again, it's something that we knew was coming, but what have we done to prepare for it? Little, it seems, at the highest levels of our government. And that's another area of responsibility that we will have to, and this is the role of journalism, we will have to hold the administration to account.
Well, when we come back into the Beltway, into Washington, D.C., that's just another drop in the bucket that goes along with the two finance plans, one the infrastructure and the other the Democratic plan to revive jobs. This now falls in the lap once again of the House and Senate, and it appears Democrats might be able to get the first two strokes of this, but I think this housing moratorium for evictions is going to be a real tough hill to climb for people that want to keep it enabled.
Yes, strap on your seatbelts. It's going to be a rocky time in Congress as they gather again as the fall approaches. But there are plans. Let's see if they stand up to the test of getting these two massive pieces of legislation through. It's interesting what kind of a momentum has been built up behind these Biden plans. It also will be interesting to see the Speaker of the House exert her capacities for what was it once called? She can count, and she knows math. Well, that particular element of leadership will be put to the ultimate test, getting these pieces of legislation through, of course. And we must not ever forget the very tight balance of power in the Senate too, and I expect to see the Vice President Kamala Harris as a critical pivotal force in that. She will be in a position as a casting vote sometimes in the Senate, be called upon, I think, to do what's most important perhaps in her constitutional role.
Well, one final comment, David. We have about a minute and a half left. After years and years of you covering news stories and being a correspondent all over the world, do you ever just seem to get tired of the way violence has evolved and terrorism has evolved and the lack of sanctity of human life has evolved? Does it ever get to you?
The short answer is yes, of course. I wouldn't be human if it didn't. But you raised an interesting parallel earlier on, and I couldn't help thinking back on on my career. I reported on Northern Irish terrorism, and Northern Irish, more importantly perhaps, I think, the groundswell of disaffection that gave rise to terrorism in Northern Ireland. And of course, many things have changed, not least that development we were talking about earlier of the suicide bomber, which changed the nature of the equation. But But the sense of disaffection and how it is that terrorism can operate based on a disaffected population is always important to understand, and it's the journalist's job to enable people to understand what motivates terrorism in the first place. And the other end of it too, which you referred to also a little earlier, is that in some strange way, if we're prepared for it, we can in a sense live with it too, and that's an important part of the equation too. Britain was not exactly held hostage by the IRA, but it was certainly in a position of stasis, if you like. It was a stalemate for a long time between terrorists on the one hand and the security forces of the state on the other hand, and yet we got on with our lives both in the island of Ireland and in the mainland of Britain, and it's an instructive lesson perhaps. If you're thorough enough and your expertise is determined enough and applied well enough, you can actually get through horrible situations for a considerable length of time. And eventually, in the end, partly, I guess, because populations do tire of such tension, there is a momentum for peace and for settlement, finally.
David, we'll speak to you again next week. One more week in the great state of Maine, right?
That's what it looks like.
All right. Have a great week up there. We'll speak to you next week, David.
Look forward to that.
David Taraschuk with the Media Beat here on Robin Hood Radio. Of course, you can find David's website at themediabeat.us. You can also find David on our website, robinhoodradio.com. Click on On Demand. Click on the Media Beat with David Taraschuk, and live on a Friday morning and rebroadcast during the weekend and following our new news on Monday here on Robin Hood Radio.